Hey, we had our end of term party last week, so we took a week off. But this week, we're back, and this week on the PhD cast, we're talking Dove's new campaign for Real Beauty, Twitter hashtag music launches, the latest wearable sexy underwear from Durex, and also, what is a creative technologist, and exactly what do they do? This, and more besides, in the PhD cast. Hello, welcome to the PhD cast. It's Chris. Joining me on the podcast today is Nicola Davey.
Hello.
And Morgan Stokes.
Hi.
And Mimi Lou.
Hi.
And Stuart Gurney.
Good afternoon, everybody.
How's everybody doing?
Very excited.
So loads to talk about this week. Lots of stuff going on. First up, new campaign from Dove. Mimi, tell us all about it.
Well, it's basically the next iteration of Dove's Real Beauty campaign. And what it had is they have a guy who actually draws the people's faces from the police station. And they get the real women to come in and basically get them to describe how they actually think they look like. And then he draws them. He doesn't actually see them throughout the entire thing. And then they bring another stranger who's actually met these real women, and then they actually describe how they see these women, and then they compare the two pictures together.
Cool. And the upshot is that women tend to think themselves as less beautiful than other people think they are.
Yes, exactly right.
Nick, what do you make of this?
Well, I thought it was a really beautiful execution. I thought it was
really... You nearly cried, didn't you?
Yeah, I did actually really nearly cry. And I think it's a great way of extending a fantastic platform of Real Beauty and giving it, you know, a new, as Mimi said, it's a new iteration and looking at from a new angle. I think my mind's been quite clouded by reading some blogs recently of people really heavily critiquing it, critiquing their use of cultural diversification in it and portraying still that beauty still means pale skin, blue eyes and being thin. But I'm trying to not let that overshadow actually what my take out of it and you know, the bottom of it was that actually other people perceive you to be far more beautiful, however you want to interpret beautiful, than yourself. So I gave it a big tick actually.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's an interesting evolution of their previous campaigns. And it's so, the thing I like about it from an Ehrenberg Bass point of view, Nicola, is that it's great to have a distinctive asset. So this idea of Real Beauty is awesome because they've had it for about 10 years now and they keep it fresh by evolving the insight. And it is a genuine insight that links back to that kind of master thought. So for me, it's a great articulation of a well-established campaign and a distinctive asset.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's Real Beauty as a campaign is now really kind of up there with the Let's Do It's, those long-standing, those really great, what we at PhD would call a thought leader that just keeps those the washing brand strategy with just campaign after campaign coming off it in really credible ways.
Yeah, I thought it was great, this particular execution as well, because they sort of made this execution about the individual. Somebody mentioned it in Foreplay yesterday, but opposed to Dove.
Foreplay's our session, not just the...
Foreplay's PhD's weekly debate and conversation about media. It's not just Morgan...
Just getting
personal.
Kinky. That's later on.
So yeah, you're saying it was discussed yesterday.
Yeah, so it was more about the individual, whereas previous campaigns have been sort of about groups or women as a general. And I thought this was particularly good because this campaign was actually centered around the office and the women in my pod. It all instantly sparked a conversation between them. And I don't think I related as much as a man, but I thought it was a bit overly... emotional for me, but it seemed to get all the women like really motivated and started talking about that real beauty.
Yeah, I do agree that, but I think the reason why they actually made it quite kind of overt is because they wanted to kind of spark that emotional reaction from everyone. But I'd like to see how they actually expand that campaign out. I'm guessing the problem they actually have with the problem that they actually have with the actual all the cultural diversity and stuff, is that maybe next one, when they're doing it in China, when they're doing it in the different Europe, so they might have different people appearing on the ads, and when they actually do kind of reduce it down to 30 seconds or 60 seconds.
I think that's a really good point, actually, because Unilever are great about thinking about different markets and taking an idea and translating it to the market. So it's a really clear idea. So as you said, it'd be great to understand how they think about it from a global planning point of view and turn that really nice thought into local media and communication activations.
And it's already been parodied. Yeah.
It's always a sign of a good idea, really, isn't it?
Great.
And the fact that still works. That's still it. Talking about Ehrenberg Bass Institute, although that word failed my memory earlier today. Talking about Ehrenberg Bass.
It's okay, no one knows this.
Well, I'm just saying, in case you're listening, Fraternity Media of Sydney. I know I forgot it. Anyway, it's a real testament to a very distinctive asset that they've got in. Not only real beauty as an over explicit expression, but actually the sentiment and what sits behind it, which is, you know, that parody still works for me in building Dove mental availability.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the parody basically, someone in the States has done it, swapping it around, so what blokes think of themselves, and obviously it's overinflated and very. Egocentric, and actually
they think they're hotter than they are.
Basically, so they actually look. The way they describe themselves is more like movie stars, and the way that people describe them is more like creatures from The Lord of the Rings,
which of course isn't true at all. I'm sure men are incredibly conservative in terms of how they rate themselves. So up next this week, Twitter has launched this new music discovery service, claiming it will revolutionise the way people think, or link rather, with new artists. B&T report the site, saying that the platform works by monitoring Twitter activity, including tweets and engagement, to detect which tracks are most popular. Emerging artists and heroes, the accounts and musicians, to see what they're tapping into. Twitter and music go great together. We Are Hunted founder Stephen Phillips wrote, people share and discover new songs and albums every day. Stu, what is this? What's going on? What's Twitter music?
As far as I understand, it's a hashtag music app that will understand and look at the songs that people have been looking at. So it's kind of... it's been described as the 21st century version of the mixtape. So it can recommend music and tracks based on artists that you follow. It's a really interesting move, I think, for Twitter to try and get on the music bandwagon. I think it's a massive space, and Facebook have done it a little bit, and especially using Spotify, it's a great way of discovering new music, and becomes very, very great for advertisers. I think advertising takes it into an interesting space, because a lot of questions have been asked all around where's the money for Twitter. So how are they going to possibly start remunerating even around this proposition? And I think as it stands at the moment, the app works by detecting kind of the most popular tracks from people you follow. And iTunes, you can actually play previews, but if you're a premium subscriber of Spotify, you can actually listen to the full track. So it's a great way of discovering new music based on connections in your social network.
So is it going to be an actual app that I need to now put on my device? Like, is it a music player?
Yeah, you have to download the iPhone app to use it. So you can't run it through Twitter. It's a separate app you have to download, or you can watch it on
I think I've just
had
a
desktop.
How many more music apps can I possibly get?
I agree. As Stu said, they're jumping on the music bandwagon. I don't really think there's a space for Twitter to come into it. I mean, MySpace is rebranded to try to be this new music platform, social platform, and then Facebook has tried it with this sort of Spotify integration.
iTunes,
Pandora,
there's now music in the Play Store from Android, Spotify, of course.
Even JB Hi-Fi has their own.
Even JB Hi-Fi. So this is a really cluttered space.
Yes,
so
definitely.
So what are they bringing to the table that's different on you?
The power of Twitter, I guess. It's the assumption around the fact that there's the social connection that people have on Twitter. But for me, that is a bit of a misnomer, because you go, do I really care what Whoopi Goldberg is listening to?
Exactly.
Or Miranda Hart?
I suppose it's not just Miranda Hart or Whoopi Goldberg, although personally I am very interested in what both of those fine ladies are listening to. I suppose it's the idea of the wisdom of crowds, and the idea that actually millions of people all around the world will be much better at identifying what the best tracks emerging artists are than any, even any individual experts. We know this from SuiWiki and the Wisdom of Crowds. We know that all of us are smarter than any of us, right?
But I don't think Twitter should actually own that space. I mean, because they actually have integrated... actually, Pandora has Facebook and Twitter integrated into their existing website and app. So that just means that Twitter's trying to basically close the wall on everything else and just carve that space out for themselves to actually monetize. And they just see it as another commercial opportunity, really, rather than them actually contributing any additional value towards the user or the consumer.
And I kind of don't buy your argument around Wisdom of Crowds, Christopher, because...
What?
I know, me being contentious. Because, like, effectively, we've always had the charts, which is the wisdom of the crowds, effectively. And just because a few hipsters on Twitter follow certain people, that's not a simplification.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I think that if you look at...
Bob the Builder,
if you look at, but Bob the Builder was number one in an age when... mass media and where advertising and music studios could promote big artists that they wanted to get into the top 10. That was a mass media machine driving that, the X Factor.
But Twitter is a mass media machine.
Mass media.
Yeah, but it's a crowd of individuals rather than the few people kind of controlling or buying paid media to influence.
Yeah, not paid media, but there's definite influence that happens in Twitter. Just the sheer
of course there is, but that influence has credibility. In a, you haven't got credibility because of who you are. You've got credibility because of what other people think of you. And so it's a more credible platform, more credible source of what's emerging. Surely.
Depends on the people following, arguably. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's lots of debates around like, is that more credible or not? I don't necessarily think. I think the influence thing is an interesting debate because I doubt that music companies and producers will let the egalitarian of music and Twitter naturally meet, and that just won't happen. I mean, I think every artist has a Twitter account. Every artist is now completely plugged into social media, so... And that is very deliberate. That's not a case of them as a complete marketing ploy. So I don't think it's that as good as that egalitarian.
And I think music is also a very individual thing. Like, I'm sure no one person's music taste is the same as another person's. So that really means that why do I actually want to listen to what my best friend wants to listen to? I might actually have a completely different taste of music to who they are, even if we're best friends or even if I value their opinion.
I've actually got a massive aversion to people knowing what I'm listening to because I'd be really embarrassed most of the time
I'm listening to. So many of my friends are going, how do I block what I'm listening to on Spotify?
I hope it doesn't come up on Facebook what I'm listening to on Spotify because I don't know how you block it, but if it does, it's just like you know, I listen to a lot of like not cool stuff.
The community often listens to Duran Duran and such classics of the 80s, and I often get that on my newsfeed.
And it's not like Biggie Connerty to hold back in social media, right?
Exactly.
Okay, anything else on that?
I was just going to agree with your point. I think everybody's guilty of listening to an embarrassing song here and there. And so I beg to like question why even socialise music. I don't know, is that necessary?
Let's keep going.
Go on. In what way?
I don't know if we have to share absolutely every single bit of our lives. I think Instagram is something different where you get to share like a specific moment that you're living, but like something that you're listening to and you can keep on listening to. I don't know if that's necessary.
It's interesting because I think like music's always been a way for especially kind of for younger generations and younger audiences to define a sense of self and purpose. So it's always been a badge of identification. So it's helped craft who you are.
Yeah.
What music you listen to. So for younger audiences, I completely see that as a really important way of navigating. So the wisdom of kind of tribalism and finding like-minded people who like the same thing, that's where you get kind of goths, etc., etc. So for that to become mass is quite interesting.
But it's interesting for you, Morgan, to be saying this, because in two of PhD's books that we wrote, one Fluid and then later in 2016, both books touched on this idea of social sharing, and they predict that a group of probably younger, but not necessarily younger people, or Gen Ys, dare I say it, would emerge, who would be super sharers, who would have no boundaries, no considerations around what they were putting out on social media, that the Zuckerberg has said there's no such thing as privacy anymore. Mm-hmm. So we talk this idea of a group emerging who will be super sharers and who won't have those concerns about privacy in that regard.
Yeah. Well, there's loads of instances of that, the kind of Snap ghost chat thing. What was it called?
Snapchat.
Snapchat. Where you can take photos of yourself. I think we've talked about it before on the podcast, but where you can take photos and they only last in
10 minutes or something.
A second, depending on how long you want have it in there. So mm-hmm. that transience of the content you're creating, and I'm sure there's loads of risque things happening using that app.
Which is very alien to me. I'm all about live caching. right, from Twitter then to another new campaign this week. The campaign from the leading condom manufacturer, Durex, it says here, via Umbrella, is built around the idea of connecting when you're apart. It allows couples to use a mobile application to activate sensors on their underwear, which stimulate human touch.
Chris is blushing.
I was about to say that. I've never seen Chris blush.
That's his saying it.
From the sublimeness of Twitter music to the ridiculousness of Durex, what do we make of this?
Awesome idea. So basically, they've created... what?
Go on.
Basically, yeah. They've created some... it feels like, at the moment...
I'm sure it does feel like it.
But they've created... so physical... physical wear.
Underwear
is the word I was looking for, thank you, Mimi. That you can enter a competition to win the chance of winning, you and your partner, and then you can actually communicate long distances via mobile phones, and it stimulates certain areas of that underwear basically cyber sex foreplay esque using Durex, which is a great insight.
I think it's great.
Is it great? Go on.
Yeah, no, the product, like when I watched the video, I was like, how does this product not exist already? It just makes so much sense. It sort of like removes that gap in distance, long distance relationships.
I'm really shy now.
What? It makes so much sense. I was just like, wow, that's genius.
And it's interesting, you're talking about the lack of how younger generations are increasingly going to want to share stuff. This is a great example of that. So I only think now there's the amount of sharing that happens and the amount of kind of comfortableness we are with risque things in current society. So you got like
chat
roulette is what I was thinking, and all those kind of things, which just kind of I'm not declassify, but kind of take the onus out of the sexual risqueness that we have as a society. And
so,
I think it's a great idea.
So just Umbrella quoting the Daily Telegraph in the UK, who are themselves reporting a guy called Ben Moir, I'm going to say, M-O-I-R. He's the technical director of the project. He said, after the laughter had stopped, we knew it was going to be an awesome project. People will want this. And that for me just kind of sums this up, right? This is a gimmick, right?
Yeah.
This is off the scale. I mean, this isn't something that people are going to... We haven't invented a new segment of underwear here, have we?
Yes.
Well, yes.
I'm wearing it now.
Well, if it delivers results, then why wouldn't it create a new segment?
Oh. I think that's what I like about it. I think that there's the brand has gone and said, right, how do we diversify in what we do? Yeah. Well, you know, what they're doing here is making sure that their brand is still salient and always being top of mind. And they've done this so well with how they've diversified out of their kind of functional purpose and product of being condoms into... you know, other
different experiences.
Yeah, experiences. And I just think that
it's like the Nike Fuel brand. Nike Fuel band of Durex.
Yeah, awesome. And it's making new kind of stuff that there would definitely be some sexy people out there that would want to use it.
Cool. So, I do think it's absolutely ridiculous, but I suppose it is another interesting example of this wearable tech, which we're increasingly seeing. I'm moving on to the last thing we're going to talk about this week, which is a report by Campaign Brief. Campaign Brief report on an IAA panel which lifted the shroud on creative technologists and creative technology at a forum hosted by MNC Saatchi in Sydney in the last week. Just Do It, they report, was the abiding message for creative technologists and those who aspire to be them. a panel from people such as Amnesia Razorfish's E. MacDonald, Evan C. Saatchi's James Bush, and people like them had a discussion and pondered what creative technologists are, what is it they do, and how they can contribute to marketing. Mimi, you were there, is that right?
Yes, it was.
How'd it go?
It was quite an interesting debate around, a lot of it was around whether or not they actually needed to know to code or not to code. There were obviously very two schools of thought. Obviously, the people who were natural coders and who knew at least 7 to 9 coding languages thought...
Which most of us do.
Yeah,
yeah, obviously. Of course, PhD people do. And obviously they thought that it was very necessary for them to actually be able to bring any ideas they come up with to life, and they can actually do it and think about the feasibility of it rather than to kind of go back to a developer to say yes or no. And the people who thought that they don't need to code is a lot of that is around outsourcing and actually them coming up with the idea. It was more about having that ability to actually understand how technology can deliver on that comms objective or to solve that business problem.
Cool.
So there was not really a clear answer still, but it's always very clear that to be a creative technologist, you actually need to know actually three main sections to be able to actually think about it, to make things, and obviously understand how the user will use these things.
I think it's a really interesting thing to discuss in context of, once again, bringing back the jurors example.
I thought that wouldn't be going
away. Because it's a great example of potentially the use of creative technology. So that taking the brand experience and elevating it above advertising, I mean, it could be a gimmick, it might not be a gimmick, but it does take it beyond, through you can start to elevate you can elevate the brand purpose into something that's bigger than just I can't use bigger now, everything's gonna be a pun. Oh no. Anyway, yeah, it's good.
So really sick question. Just for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, what is a creative technologist?
A creative technologist is someone who actually combines the creative skills of like a digital strategist, a coder, a developer, and actually combines that with the technical skills of a coder or a software engineer, basically. And they're able to then actually make ideas that actually are based around technology to come alive. And I personally don't really like those two words together because they're really an oxymoron, really.
Ooh, right, really?
In the sense of, it's quite wanky to say. Should I be saying those words?
You're now an 18.
But in the sense of, everyone should, like in nowadays, should understand what technology does and how that delivers on each of their clients, whether or not technology can deliver for their clients or their agency. So...
I think Stu bringing it back to the Durex product development, if we're going to call it a product, let's go with it, it's going to be a product development, is a good example, because through the lens of creative technologists, where would that person have required to have sat to be able to develop that as an idea? So it's, it appears to be being living and breathing as a communication idea, but does that mean that the concept and that idea should have been generated by an agency, or is the brand and the creative technologists that are sitting client side, are they the ones responsible for coming up with this idea and then disseminating that through their marketing efforts? So yeah, I think it does raise a really important question on if creative technologists exist, in the oxymoron of being creative and a technologist, where is their role most important?
Yeah. And I would echo that, and I think that the skill set's really important for agency land, be that creative, media, or whoever, and understanding technology, understanding the basics of coding. I don't think you have to necessarily be coding experts for our day-to-day jobs, but understanding how things work in that space is really important. But by Mimi's point, that is a bit wanky, creative technologists, because it doesn't feel like... It feels a bit like a land grab for creative agencies to try and hold on to this new emerging territory around technology and by calling it something and giving it a name and having a conference around it,
it
starts to justify
high salary.
Exactly.
And I also think it's a bit of chicken or egg. So when you're coming up with, you know, before the Fundaware was created.
Did you just make that up?
Fundaware. Come on, 10 lovers. So Fundaware. The chicken and egg situation for me is, do you need to code to be able to know the capabilities of what that code, what the experience of that code could create and develop? Or is it enough to know what the experience is and to find ways of being able to do that? And what's the time constraints within that, and what's the budget constraints? And something that I think that a creative technologist, it sounds to me, if they have those perfect blend of skills of knowing what the consumer or the brand experience would be, understanding how they can make it and understanding what the idea is, that they can actually go and build and make these prototypes and make things work a lot quicker, which is, you know, has a big competitive advantage for that brand or business.
That's it. A whistle top tour of the week from the PhD cast. A big, big thank you to Nicola Davey.
Woo!
And Morgan Stokes.
Woo!
And Louis Lou.
Woo!
And Stuart Hadley. Stuart
Hadley. Love child of Martin Gatley.
Stuart Kearney. Thanks,
Stuart.
I've got no idea what happened. Have an amazing weekend, everyone. This has been the PhD cast.
Bye.
I've got no idea what happened there. It's absolutely ridiculous. Right, thanks, that was quite good.
Yeah,
I thought
that was
quite cool.
I'm not right.
Blushing around.
Yeah.
You
titty, that
was
my favourite word.
Do you know, because I was saying, and I was trying to stop saying, and then I tried to do it as a pun, and then it came out as like a double pun.
I thought, given the potential for innuendo and an absolute sentence of ridiculous, we did quite well.